Hi, welcome to TechMag. This episode features Guy Kawasaki, venture capitalist from California. We talked about Corona, making money in these tough times, surfing, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our talk.
Guy Kawasaki, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I just got out of the water. I just stopped surfing, so.
Yeah.
Literally.
You're in Silicon Valley, right?
I'm in Santa Cruz, California right now.
Okay. Well, that's nice. So tell me, how have the past few months been for you? Did the pandemic change you?
Well, the pandemic has changed everybody. It's if you have to be someplace, California is not a bad place. There's a lot of pain and suffering and tragedy, but you know, you have to shelter in place, you have to wear a mask, you have to wash your hands, you have to do these things that make sense. And hopefully, if we all work together, we can get through this.
Yeah, but like, from where I am, working together in the US sometimes seems to be a bit of a struggle with politics and everything that's been going on.
Very much so, yes. Where are you located?
Belgium.
Yeah.
But did you have a hard time adjusting to the new way of working, new way of living?
Well, I have not quote unquote worked for a company, you know, in the sense of going to an office for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. So working at home by myself, virtually connecting, has been my norm for quite a long time.
So this wasn't,
No. I made greater investment in technology and stuff to do it better. And you know, hopefully you can see the results that my video and my audio is probably better than most people's. I've had to make that investment because before it was just, you know, get on a Zoom call and all that. And you weren't really recording things that were being deployed for keynotes, but now I am. So I often pre-record keynotes, and you know, that you have to just take it up a level.
Yeah, and how about on a personal level, like being at home all the time?
If anything, I got to spend more time with my family. So
yeah,
there's been some benefits too.
Well, I listened to your Bad Times Make Good Companies episode. And I'm wondering, tell me, how were you able to remain creative in the times of the coronavirus?
A lot of it is just gutting it out and grinding it out and gritting it out. It's you know, not a trivial thing. You can get into a deep funk, obviously, in a pandemic, duh. But someday this pandemic will end. And now, you know, you can either kind of be inactive and just wait for external factors to change, or you can be proactive and try to prepare, create new products and services, innovate, learn new skills. A lot of that depends on the perspective of the person.
You know,
some people have a growth mindset and some people don't have a growth mindset.
Is this something you can develop, a growth mindset, and how can you do that?
Boy, I wish I'm not exactly a professional psychiatrist or psychologist. I don't know the answer to that.
You do have a Stanford degree.
I do have a Stanford degree, but you know, that's not the same as being an expert. And I guess it really is a matter of sort of perspective and psychology and attitudes toward life.
Do you have any example of that? Something you do yourself, maybe like a habit or things you do in order to keep the mindset?
I wish, I'm kind of naturally a person who is, you know, up and who is positive and who is willing to work hard. So that's just in my DNA.
Yeah.
So that comes naturally to me.
Even in times with Trump, and I saw you post a lot of tweets about him too. So if I lived there, for me, it would be hard to remain positive all the time, to be honest.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see your point. But I mean, what are the alternatives? Just give up and don't resist? Right. That would arguably yield something even worse.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Is there any company or someone in particular you look up to for their way of dealing with the crisis?
I would say that Patagonia provides a great example of resistance and, you know, great products and services. the philosophy of the CEO and founder, I think is, you know, very, very attractive to me. So
how so?
Patagonia really believes in, you know, being a shepherd of the environment and standing for democracy, meritocracy, equality, you know, open-mindedness, all that kind of good stuff. And it really does put its money where its mouth is. So Patagonia, I think, is a very good example of corporate responsibility.
And it's someone in your close environment too?
To tell you the truth, I don't really hang out with billionaires and CEOs anymore.
No, but I'm not even talking about them. It could be a family member.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, my wife is a force of positive energy for sure. So yeah, that is definitely true. But it's not like I'm hanging out with Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and, you know, Warren Buffett and so.
But you did hang out with the Gary Vee for one of your podcasts.
That's true. So, you know, my podcast, which is in about the 40th episode right now, I mean, I've had just remarkably positive, successful people. I mean, it's like Jane Goodall, Margaret Atwood, Andrew Yang, Steve Wozniak, Gary Vee, iJustine, Steve Wolfram, David Acker, Bob Cialdini, Christy Yamaguchi, Roy Yamaguchi, Sean Thompson. I mean, these people, it's hard to listen to them and remain in a downward sort of mood.
Yeah. What are the most inspiring things you've learned so far from any of them?
Certainly, one of the people who is probably one of the less known people, she was smuggled across the U.S.-Mexico border and as a baby, and now works for Adobe in a, you know, high-ranking management position. I found her story particularly remarkable and inspiring because she truly did start with nothing.
Yeah, but didn't you either?
No, I mean, I came from a lower middle-class family in Hawaii, but, you know, I'm third-generation Japanese-American. There was no way that I struggled the way she did or many immigrants have.
Yeah. But, I mean, sometimes when I mean, obviously we met a lot at South by Southwest and so forth, but I wonder how you, someone like you, this down to earth. I find that remarkable or admirable.
I don't know. I mean, that also may be DNA. I don't know why that's true. Maybe my wife keeps me honest.
Maybe on Twitter, you said that if only Bill Campbell, the executive coach to a number of Silicon Valley executives.
Yeah, we're still alive.
Yeah. How would he have dealt with this?
Well, there is that great article in Fast Company that people should go look for. And he was a remarkable person. He would definitely be on the podcast were he alive. And he was like a coach, mentor, father figure for many, many successful people in the Valley.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I also asked Seth Godin this question. How do you believe this crisis has impacted marketing?
It's forced the total digitization of marketing because obviously we're not having trade shows and we're not having conventions. It has probably made email even more important. It has made arguably Instagram and Facebook more important, which can be a good or bad thing because they are very good at targeting people, which also is a good or bad thing. So that's true. I also think that in a sense, marketing can be made simpler right now because people's expectations are lower, that, you know, you don't expect every gadget in every color and every configuration and every size and everything, right? So I don't know about you, but I'm just happy to get whatever I order or something close to it.
Yeah. And some would say that people are even more demanding right now because they are feeling
maybe, but that's not, I am certainly not more demanding. And I think that, you know, my observation is people are less demanding because, you know, I like a specific kind of peanut butter, but if I go to the market or I use, you know, Instacart and they don't bring the exact one I want, I don't care. I just want some kind of peanut butter. So I'm a lot less fussy. For me, I'd rather have something that's kind of close to what I want that I can get and then to have this perfect thing that I have to wait for.
Yeah. But what does that mean for the customer experience of the future?
Well, I mean,
talking about arguably,
yeah, it lowers expectations, I think, but that may be necessary in a post-pandemic world. That, you know, you'd have to really think twice about putting all your, you know, eggs in the basket that's 6,000 miles away in a trade war with your country, because, you know, who knows what some premier or some president is going to do that's going to affect your product. So that definitely has, your supply chain is definitely a risk factor right now.
Yeah. How can companies be more future-proof when it comes to that?
Well, you'd have to say that you hedge your bets. You know, maybe you have manufacturing in China and Vietnam and South Korea. I mean, you know, multiple places, not just all in one country, in one city. And if that country is in a trade war with you, or if that country has a virus and is shut down, I mean, you are kind of hosed if all your production is from one place.
That's true, yeah. So in lots of articles going around, people are talking about how we should be living differently, more sustainably, caring for the planet way more. Is this something you try to do in your both personal and professional life too?
Well, yeah, I try to do it, but I don't hold myself up as a great example of that. You know,
none of us are.
Well, but I realize I'm not, at least.
Is there anything you do, you are actually proud of, that you're doing or changing, or?
Well, I certainly, well, I mean, in a sense, it's forced upon me. It's not that I'm a good person, but I haven't ridden an airplane since, I don't know, February or March. I have no intention of getting on an airplane until there's a vaccine. So hopefully that reduces my carbon footprint. and I basically, I seldom drive anymore. I mean, it's, now again, you know, it's not because I've like, you know, don't be overly impressed. I mean, a lot of this is just forced upon me, right? If you're sheltering in place and you're not supposed to travel and you're not supposed to fly, and you know, you're afraid of staying in hotels, then it's not a moral decision. You had no decision, but yeah. You know, the end result is a smaller footprint.
Did you know that we actually ended up going to Austin in March when things were really unclear whether we should go or not? I mean, the event was canceled, but we thought, hey, yeah, why shouldn't we go just work in good weather? And then things went crazy and we had to fly back after 4 days and we were just back home in time. And then our country went in lockdown.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was.
Did you have to quarantine for 2 weeks or anything like that?
No, not yet, because this was just like in March, in the very early beginning. Yeah.
And how is Belgium doing now? I'm just not familiar.
Well, we're doing bad. We're reaching 10,000 deaths, but we're only a country with a population of 11 million people. So that's really bad. And we had like, you know, over summer, the numbers kept going up, then a little bit down, and then up again. So everyone's talking about this new way of working, new way of living. And you're still with companies like Canva. How have they survived, or how are they dealing with the crisis?
Well, I mean, basically everybody's totally virtual, right? And so, you know, I have two sons who are in the workforce right now. One works for Google and one works for eBay. And the Google employee, I think it's almost like to the end of 21 before he's supposed to go back to an office or something like that. I mean, it's a long time. It's not, you know, it's not like we all believe on November 1st there's going to be a vaccine and we all get in our cars and go back to work. I mean, only a fool would believe that.
Yeah.
So it's completely changed. And I think that we're going to look back and say, wow, this really caused a lot of changes, many of them for good, that, you know, about working virtually, about still being productive. I think it's too early to call and say it's an unmitigated productivity disaster.
Yeah.
We don't know yet.
Yeah. So what is your role at Canva right now? Do you still evangelize?
Yes. You know, I'm sort of a public figure for the company. And it's kind of totally outward focused, spreading the good news of Canva.
Yeah. And how's that working out during a pandemic?
Canva is just busting out. I mean, we have about 35 million monthly active users.
I'm one of them.
And yeah, good. Good. We have 35 million monthly active users. And we make, believe it or not, 6 or 7 million graphics every day. I mean, 6 or 7 million graphics. Wrap your head around that. I can't even wrap my head around that.
Again, I'm one of them. I use them. Yeah, I do. I even became a paying customer recently. So I remember last year at South by Southwest, you showed me a new kind of social medium with only photos. Do you remember that? It was a new app.
Privy?
Yeah, that one.
Yes. Oh, so I still use Privy every day. So it is an anti-social social media kind of network.
Yeah.
And what it involves is double opt-in. So, you know, right now people can comment, like, et cetera, to your public persona, right? And they don't have permission to do that. They can, that's just part of the system. But Privy, as the name would imply, is much more privacy oriented. So it's double opt-in in the sense that you have to be asked and you have to agree before you can start a relationship with someone. So with Privy, I have a group of surfers and I have a family group, and you know they have to be invited and they have to agree to be in the group. So it's like Instagram with privacy in a sense.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. Could this be like become like a competitor for Instagram?
Oh, I wish. I mean, we'll see. That's a tall order. But yeah, it's, you know, it's really great if you want to build a controlled community.
Yeah.
Right. So let's say you want to make a Privy community just for the kids and parents and teachers of one class at a school. Right. So whoever starts that group has total control over who's in it. And you cannot be put in it without your conscious decision to say yes, which is what you would want in an educational group, right? So only the kids and parents and teachers are invited, and they are only in if they accept. Think about how that's such an advantage when you want to control what's happening.
Do you think that's a better alternative as opposed to what Facebook is doing today?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, listen, there's the business model will be a paid subscription of a few bucks a month. So, you know, with Facebook, in one sense, how can anybody complain? You know, no one's forcing you to use Facebook. So if you don't like what Facebook does, don't use it. Otherwise, when they advertise to you, shut up, because, you know, they have to pay the bills somehow. So, you know, it's not an involuntary act to use Facebook, so get over it.
Do you think that people are being hypocrites about that?
Which people? There's a lot of hypocrites in the world.
Complaining about Facebook?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I actually do. I mean, how do you complain about Facebook? Just don't use it. Is, you know, nobody's forcing you to use it. It's not like Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, got something on you that you have to use Facebook. If you don't like it, don't use it. If you don't like the ads, ignore them. I mean, what's the problem? I'm, you know, if you have cable TV and one of the channels is conservative or 24/7 selling you tourmaline bracelets, change the channel. I mean, nobody says you have to watch that channel.
So you wouldn't say that, because that's what's being said about platforms like Facebook a lot, that we people, as people, we are the product. You don't believe in that kind of stuff?
We are the product in the sense that we have given our data and information in order to be advertised to. Well, I mean, you know, that is the exchange.
Yeah.
But it is a voluntary exchange. I mean, listen, it's not like I'm saying Facebook is you know, totally good and pure and all that. Push comes to shove, quit Facebook. I mean,
have you quit Facebook?
No, but I don't complain either. So for me, social media, honestly, is a means to an end. And I don't care about making new relationships and new friends on social media. I have a wife and I have four children and I have a small circle of friends. That's all I care about. I don't want to have more relationships. I can't handle any more relationships. So basically, my use of social media is a tool to promote Canva, my podcasts, Privy. My books, my speeches, Privy. Yeah. And so, you know, do I go on Facebook and get my news? Do I pay attention to any ads? Okay, this is absolutely honest and true. All right. So I post to Facebook, I don't know, 10 times a day. Do you want to know how many times a day I go and read Facebook and read the timeline? Zero. Zero. So
what about
for all I know, I'm getting a bunch of Trump ads, but I have no idea because I don't go there to read. I only push out content there.
Yeah. And what about Twitter?
Twitter, I go and I, once or twice a day, I check anybody who at mentions me just because I want to see if I owe any thank you to anybody who has said my podcast is good, Canva is good, whatever. So I feel that's like just out of politeness. But do I go to Twitter and look at the trending topics? Do I, you know, follow Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell or, you know, Ted Cruz? Absolutely not.
Would you say that you avoid the news at all?
No, I don't avoid the news at all. I view my role on social media as a curator. So I read the news. I use Google News and I use Smart News. And I also go to some sites, you know, homepage, like NPR and The Atlantic. But basically, between Google News and Smart News, I'm always looking for stories to repost. But that's my news sources. I don't use social media for news at all.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, but you got a degree in psychology from Stanford University, and then you wound up, how has the art of psychology shaped or helped your career in some kind?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could draw a direct line from point A to point B. First of all, you know, I got my psychology degree in 1976, so that's a long time ago. It's very hard to say, okay, I learned this in college and I applied it here in my career at this point.
You seem to have a lot of empathy and you know how to deal with people. Is that something you've learned?
Well, believe it or not, Phil Zimbardo, the Stanford professor, has become one of my close friends. And so he's, you know, Mr. Social Psychology. And another really big influence is a person named Bob Cialdini. Bob Cialdini wrote a book called Influence. And I highly recommend that book.
Why?
Because it is so practical and tactical about your day-to-day relationships. I mean, anybody who's in marketing or sales or entrepreneurship should read Influence by Bob Cialdini.
Okay, noted. So tell me, how do you feel about not knowing what you don't know? I bet no one has ever asked you that question before.
How do I feel about not knowing what I don't know?
Yeah.
Doesn't keep me up at night, but it's at least good to know what you don't know. I would make the case that in particular in politics right now in the United States, there are many people who don't know what they don't know, but they try to act like they know everything. So, you know, not knowing what you don't know, or at least realizing that you may not know what you not know, is a sign of intelligence.
How so?
Well, I mean, otherwise you have this arrogant belief that you're omniscient, and that is not true. I mean, it's not true for anybody. So it's good to know that you don't know things, and it's good to know that you may not know what you don't know. So you should shut up and listen to other people sometimes.
Yeah, this is really becoming a little bit meta for me.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. I hope people aren't taking notes.
So I'm getting a little more personal right now, but what's the biggest maybe regret or mistake of your life that you now teach other people to avoid, maybe both personally and professionally?
I don't teach people, you know, what to avoid. Probably in financial terms, the biggest mistakes that I made in my life is that I quit Apple twice. I turned Steve Jobs down for another job, and I turned down an interview for the CEO position of Yahoo, the first CEO. So if I had not left Apple or I had returned to Apple, you know, that's probably, I don't know, $250 million there. And then if I had become the CEO of Yahoo, that's probably $2 billion there. So, you know, call it $2.5 billion or so. And, you know, $2.5 billion here, $2.5 billion there, pretty soon it adds up. I mean.
Didn't you once tell Steve Jobs that you didn't trust him?
Yes, I did.
Do you regret that in particular?
No. You know, after that, not immediately after, but after that, he still offered me a job. And, you know, sometimes in life, and I, you know, suggest you use this with great caution, sometimes in life, pushing back is a good thing to do when the most logical and easy thing to do is to not push back. So probably Steve respected me more for pushing back, not less.
Yeah.
One will never know.
Do you miss him?
I miss him because I think the world is a lot less interesting without his presence. I think maybe the closest thing to a Steve Jobs today is Elon Musk. But having said that, you know, if Steve Jobs were alive, I think it'd be, you know, innovation and product development and stuff would be a lot more interesting. And also, I do believe that Steve is probably telling God what to do right now. And Steve is telling God how to make universe 2.0. And because he's doing that, I know a few things about universe 2.0. First of all, it'll be late. Second, that it'll be very expensive. Third, none of the cables from this universe are going to work in the next universe. So that you can depend on.
And when will all of this be announced? Not in September.
It's going to be, you know, religion world. I don't know. I mean, it's.
I'm wondering, what do you think is your, on one side, your biggest strength, and on the other side, weakness?
Probably my biggest strength is I'm willing to work hard. You know, I love to work hard, and it's just, I'm gritty. My biggest weakness is, I don't know, sometimes a lack of attention span anyway. I'm not very patient, and I don't know, sometimes I just don't pay attention. I don't know.
I lost you there.
Yeah.
Well, in one of your interviews, you said the high road doesn't have much traffic on it. I found that really interesting. Please do. Yes.
Well, I'm saying that, you know, taking the high road, i.e. assuming people are good before, you know, they prove themselves bad, to give people the benefit of the doubt, to think that everyone can contribute, and that goes without regard to race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, all that stuff. So basically everything that the current Republican Party doesn't stand for is the high road. And so I think that there's not many people taking the high road these days. It's all, you know, nationalistic, and it's about supremacy of whatever group you're a part of, and it's not about meritocracy, it's not about equality.
Yeah, it's really depressing. If you watch the news, it's really depressing.
It is, yes.
So today, how do you unwind after a long day? I know you go surfing.
Well, yeah, sometimes I surf twice in a day, so I happen to be one block from the beach, so surfing for me is very easy, and I do it all the time. True. Wow. I do it all the time.
And is there anything else you do? Like, do you read a lot?
I binge watch. I binge watch things like Ozark.
It's a good one.
Binge watch. You know, I used to love 24. I loved Designated Survivor. I'm trying to get into. Oh, I loved Occupied. Oh my God, I love.
I haven't watched that yet, but I did. Yeah, Ozark. Oh my God, you learn to play hockey at 48, and you learn how to surf at 62. Is there something you're gonna, you know, learn at 66?
No, this is it. This is it.
You don't believe in
kids? I mean, you know, not many people take up ice hockey in their late 40s who cannot skate, you know, until then. And I took up surfing at 60 or so because of my daughter. And I had never surfed before. And
how come you like it so much?
Surfing is as much fun as you can have legally in the world. I swear. I mean, it's hard to describe the feeling of pleasure and speed and accomplishment when you catch a wave.
Yeah.
And I'm not that good at it. So imagine if you're really good. So it's hard. It's truly an adrenaline rush. It's not that dangerous. You know, it's not like, I don't know, you know, I bet you get more people get hurt mountain biking or
driving,
wingsuiting or something like that. And it's relatively inexpensive. I mean, yeah, surfboard is $1,000 to $2,000, but it's not like skiing where you spend $1,000 on equipment and then every time you go skiing, the pass is $200, right? I mean, I walk to the ocean and go surfing.
Yeah.
So
it's so amazing that it's so cool.
And it's very good exercise. It's totally occupying. Yeah, I mean, your mind. I mean, you can't be thinking about anything else out there, especially if you're not good. So yeah, it's like the sport of kings. It truly is.
So do you have any plans or ambitions for the future? Because I imagine public speaking has become different.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, I used to speak about 50 to 75 times a year, each one involving a trip. So, you know, let's call that 100, 150 days away from home. Now that's gone to zero, which I view as a good thing. Now, on the other hand, I won't tell you my numbers because it might, you know, shock you. But let's say I was making X for an in-person speech. Well, making a virtual speech is 0.25X, right? So you make 1/4 or 1/3 as much for a virtual speech as you do for an in-person speech. But an in-person speech takes 2 days, maybe three, whereas a virtual speech takes, you know, get out of the water, dry your hair, make the speech, and you're done an hour later. So maybe it's 2 hours. So it's 2 hours versus 2 to 3 days.
Well, how come you make more with a virtual?
How come what?
Oh, I thought you said you made more money doing
Yeah, from your mouth to God's ears. No. You make about a third or a quarter as much virtually. Now, maybe other speakers are doing better than me, but, you know, probably they're lying if they're telling you that. And from a conference standpoint, you know, the event manager, you know, the benefits of an in-person conference are obviously networking, you know, socializing,
book signing,
developing relationships, you know, all that kind of good stuff, right? I mean, you know, all the good stuff at South by Southwest, you could not repeat that virtually, okay? Mm. But think of how much easier it is to put on a virtual conference for 100,000 people than it is to put on a in-person conference for 100,000 people, because now you don't have to rent out the whole city of Austin. You don't have to figure out the airport. You don't have to figure out the transportation. You don't have to guarantee room nights. You don't have to, you know, get the convention center. You don't have to put in all the exhibits. You don't have to schedule all the, well, you do have to schedule appearances, but it's not like scheduling rooms in the convention center. And South by Southwest is not a good example of this because they don't pay speakers. But if you were a company, and you were, you know, you're trying to bring in Seth Godin and Gary Vaynerchuk and Guy Kawasaki and Colin Powell and I don't know, Hillary Clinton and Terry Bradshaw, if you're trying to bring in all these, you know, big names and all this kind of stuff, I mean, every one of those is 100, 200, 300,000 plus airfare, plus their entourage, you know, plus their hotel, all that bullshit. Well, now, I don't know, you know, I don't know what you pay Hillary, I don't know what you pay Hillary Clinton for a virtual appearance, but I don't think it's $250,000. So, I mean, you can get better, you can get more speakers cheaper and easier, probably. Now, again, don't get me wrong. There's a downside of the lack of personal contact, socialization, you know, not everybody likes a Zoom, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not all upside, but there are a lot of advantages to a virtual event.
Yeah. Do you think we are underestimating the psychological consequences of this pandemic? Because we're all focusing on, you know, physical health and economy. Aren't we forgetting about the psychological side of things?
I don't know. I could make the case that if you focus on the physical side and your health and all that, that probably makes the psychology effect, wait, that probably makes the psychological effect positive. So, you know, I guess there are, I think a lot of people will say, wow, I have quality family time like I never had before. But also, don't get me wrong. You know, there are probably people who are saying, oh, my kids are driving me crazy. I mean, now, you know, parenting is 24/7. Before, I could at least get rid of them for 8 hours a day. And, you know, that's not true anymore. So.
Is that what parenthood used to be about? Like getting rid of you?
In Silicon Valley. I guess. I don't know.
Do you think that like these, that's what I wanted to ask you. For do you think that these conferences like South by Southwest, are they ever taking place again?
Oh boy, that is a good question. So first of all, we have to postulate that there's this magical vaccine, right? And so this magical vaccine means that everybody can get in a plane, everybody can go to a hotel, everybody, you know, all that. Let's just assume all of that is true. So the question becomes, having gone through a year, maybe 2 years of that not being true, have we so changed our expectations and desires that when it is true, we say, you know, I'll just watch the events at South by Southwest, the particular keynotes that I want to virtually. I don't have to like fly to Austin. Or do you say, oh man, thank God I can finally get on a plane. I can go see my friends. I can eat barbecue. You know, I can watch the bats fly under the bridge. I mean, sign me up. I don't know the answer to that question.
Oh man, I miss it. I miss it so much. Not
yeah.
even
well, well, if people are like you, yeah. I mean, people will just jump back on planes. People like me, I mean, if I never get on an airplane again, it's okay with me. And
Yeah, I just priorities right now, like in terms of health.
My priority is surf and be with my family. And I will tell you that, you know, I spend an enormous amount of time on my podcast. I mean, if you looked at, I have this strange kind of inverse return on investment where the stuff that I spend the most time on, I make the least money on. So what I'm trying to tell you is I put so much effort into my podcast and I get so little financial return.
Same here.
You know, on the other hand, seriously, speaking for me is trivial. I mean, I could give a keynote in 10 minutes if you want from now. So, you know, that takes almost no effort from me. So, but I get paid a lot. So it's kind of weird, actually.
Yeah, it's same here because I'm a copywriter and I don't make money off my show, but it's what I love doing most. And I learned so much from it, from people like you. So thank you so, so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, I was getting so tired in the water anyway. It's good I came out.
So that was it. If you liked this episode, please subscribe and hope to see you next week.